Good evening and welcome to another episode of Boo, My Dad Says. My name is John.
And I'm Becca.
And we are your tour guides through the world of the paranormal.
We've got a whole lot of history, a whole lot of mystery, and a whole lot of weird.
So sit back, relax, and prepare for a spine-tingling time. Good morning, everybody, or depending on where you listen to this podcast, good afternoon, good evening, or good night. My name is John, and I am your host today for Boo, My Dad Says. Normally, I have my co-host with me, Rebecca, but she is unable to be on today's show. She had a women's retreat this weekend, and I figured by the time she gets home from that, she's going to be wiped out, and I really didn't want to have to bring her down here to record half hour to a 45 minute show, which in all honesty is an hour, hour and a half show when you account in all the cuts and redos on some of the things that we talk about. Because if we actually did show all the outtakes, number one, I would sound like a complete and utter idiot. And number two, the show would be probably an hour and a half long. But anyways, today she's not with us, and she will be back next week for the show then. If you'd like to learn more about the Boo My Dad Says podcast, you can check us out on our website at boomydadsays.com or look us up on our social media sites on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. All you got to do is just search up Boo My Dad Says, and there we'll be. Before we get going into the show, I want to give a shout out to Gabe Gallagher. His dad sent me a message on Facebook and was telling me that they really like the show. And it turns out I actually went to school with his dad. And he was telling me this story about how he was explaining that to his son. And his son was just absolutely over the moon. In his words, he thought that his dad had not known the president or something. Well, Gabe, I'm dedicating today's episode for you, so I hope you enjoy it. This week, I decided that we're going to stay across the pond for one more episode, and we're going to move down into England from the Scotland area. We're going to be going to the beautiful city of London, and we're going to be talking about the history and the hauntings of the Tower of London. And let me tell you, there is a lot of going ons at this place. I was very pleasantly unsurprised, to be honest with you, because, you know, a lot of these places have been around since, you know, the early 1000s. We're not like talking like, oh, this place was established in like 1892. No, we're talking like 1066. So there has been enough time and enough goings on that I cannot say that I am surprised at the amount of paranormal activity that happens in a place like this. I would actually be more surprised if you were to tell me that some place over in Great Britain or in Europe was not haunted, that had been around for a while. So let's take a look at the Tower of London. Let's start with the history. It was founded towards the end of 1066 as part of the Norman conquest. The White Tower, which gives the entire castle its name, was built by William the Conqueror in 1078 and was a resented symbol of oppression inflicted upon London by the new ruling elite. The castle was also used as a prison from 1100 until 1952, although that was not its primary purpose. A grand palace in its early history, it served as a royal residence. The Tower of London has played a prominent role in English history. It was besieged several times, and controlling it has been important to controlling the country. The tower has served variously as an armory, a treasury, a menagerie, the home of the royal mint, a public record office, and the home of the crown jewels of England. So looking back at the early foundation in history, Victorious at the Battle of Hastings on 14 October 1066, the invading Duke of Normandy, William the Conqueror, spent the rest of the year securing his holdings by fortifying key positions. He founded several castles along the way, but took a circuitous route towards London. Only when he reached Canterbury did he turn towards England's largest city. As the fortified bridge into London was held by Saxon troops, he decided instead to ravage Southwark before continuing his journey around southern England. A series of Norman victories along the route cut the city's supply lines, and in December 1066, isolated and intimidated, its leaders yielded London without a fight. Between 1066 and 1087, William established 36 castles, although references in the Domesday Book indicate that many more were founded by his subordinates. The ruling elite undertook what had been described as the most extensive and concentrated program of castle building in the whole history of feudal Europe. They were multi-purpose buildings serving as fortifications, used as a base of operations in enemy territory, centers of administration, and residences. William sent an advance party to prepare the city for his entrance to celebrate his victory and found a castle. In the words of William's biographer, William of Poictiers, certain fortifications were completed in the city against the restlessness of the huge, brutal populace. For he, William, realized that it was of first importance to overawe the Londoners. At the time, London was the largest town in England, the foundation of Westminster Abbey and the Old Palace of Westminster under the Edward the Confessor had marked it as a center of governance, and with a prosperous port, it was important for the Normans to establish control over the settlement. The other two castles in London, Baynard's Castle and Montfichet's Castle, were established at the same time. The fortification that would later be known as the Tower of London was built into the southeast corner of the Roman town walls, using them as prefabricated defenses, with the River Thames providing additional protection from the south. This earliest phase of the castle would have been enclosed by a ditch and defended by a timber palisade, and probably had accommodations suitable for William. Most of the early Norman castles were built from timber, but by the end of the 11th century, a few, including the Tower of London, had been renovated or replaced with stone. Work on the White Tower, which gives the whole castle its name, is usually considered to have begun in 1078. However, the exact date is uncertain. Now, the White Tower is a keep, and that is usually often the strongest structure in a medieval castle, and it contained lodgings suitable for the lord, in this case, the king or his representative. According to military historian Alan Brown, the Great White Tower was also, by virtue of its strength, majesty, and lordly accommodation, the donjon par excellence. As one of the largest keeps in the Christian world, the White Tower has been described as the most complete 11th century palace in Europe. Now, I don't know if you guys have seen like a map of the Tower of London, but the way it's laid out, you've got the Great White Tower there, kind of, it's in the middle. And then it's surrounded by a few other areas, I guess, kind of different types of fortification. You've got what's called like the innermost ward, and that's like directly kind of like down behind the White Tower. Picture the White Tower, and then you've got the River Thames behind it, and then you've got this area as the innermost ward. Then surrounding that, you have what's called the inner ward, and it's got, looks like, just like some more walls, and then they expanded out to the outer ward that was like your main, that had your main wall that fortified the tower, and then it had a moat dug around it. So that's just kind of a little bit about the layout of how the Tower of London is set up, without getting into too much detail. But it certainly, at that time, would have done a really good job of protecting the royalty of the time. The castle was later extended under William Longchamp, King Richard's Lord Chancellor and the man in charge of England while he was on crusade. Now I kind of feel like I'm getting into that Robin Hood era. King Richard's rule was from 1189 to 1199, and he left William Longchamp, I guess, to run England during that time frame. So he decided that he was going to expand the Tower of London. The Pipe Rolls recorded a 2,881 pounds spent at the Tower of London between the 3rd of December, 1189, and 11 November, 1190, from an estimated 7,000 pounds spent by Richard on castle building in England. According to the contemporary chronicler Roger of Howden, Longchamp dug a moat around the castle and tried in vain to fill it from the Thames. Longchamp was also constable of the tower and undertook its expansion while preparing for war with King Richard's younger brother, Prince John, who in Richard's absence arrived in England to try to seize power. As Longchamp's main fortress, he made the tower as strong as possible. The new fortifications were first tested in October of 1191, when the tower was besieged for the first time in its history. Longchamp capitulated to John after just 3 days, deciding he had more to gain from surrender than prolonging the siege. So the tower goes through more expansions over different periods, through the later medieval period and things like that. And I think I'm going to kind of just move forward a little bit to some different things. The beginning of the Tudor period marked the start of the decline of the Tower of London's use as a royal residence. As the 16th century chronicler Raphael Holinshed said, the tower became used more as an armories and house of munition, and thereunto a place for the safekeeping of offenders, than a palace for a king or queen to sojourn in. In the 16th century, the tower acquired an enduring reputation as a grim, forbidding prison. This had not always been the case. As a royal castle, it was used by the monarch to imprison people for various reasons. However, these were usually high-status individuals for short periods rather than common citizenry, as there were plenty of prisons elsewhere for such people. Contrary to the popular image of the tower, prisoners were able to make their life easier by purchasing amenities such as better food or tapestries through the lieutenant of the tower. As holding prisoners was originally an incidental role of the tower, as would have been the case for any castle, there was no purpose-built accommodation for prisoners until 1687, when a brick shed, a prison for soldiers, was built to the northwest of the White Tower. The tower's reputation for torture and imprisonment derives largely from 16th century religious propagandists and 19th century romanticists. Although much of the tower's reputation is exaggerated, the 16th and 17th centuries marked the castle's zenith as a prison, with many religious and political undesirables being locked away. The Privy Council had to sanction the use of torture, so it was not often used. Between 1540 and 1640, the peak of imprisonment at the Tower, there were 48 recorded cases of the use of torture. The three most common forms used were the infamous rack, the scavenger's daughter, and manacles. For those of y'all who didn't know what the scavenger's daughter was, and I didn't until I had to look it up for this, think of the rack except in reverse. You know, the rack, they would stretch you out. Well, in this case, the scavenger's daughter from what I can tell, it would basically try to squeeze you. It looks like a big A-frame. They strap your head to one end. They strap your arms to some places there in the middle, and then they would strap you around your legs at a lower spread end. The frame could then be folded, swinging the head down and forcing the knees up into a sitting position, then compressing the body as if to force the blood from the nose and ears. Ooh, that just sounds painful. But yeah, that is the Scavenger's Daughter. One of the more well-known people who was tortured at the tower was Guy Fawkes, who was brought there on November the 6th, 1605. And after torture, he signed a full confession to the gunpowder plot. Among those held and executed at the tower was Anne Boleyn, and we're going to get to her in just a little bit. Although the yeoman wanderers were once the royal bodyguard, by the 16th and 17th centuries, their main duty had become to look after the prisoners. The tower was often a safer place than other prisons in London, such as the Fleet, where disease was rife. High-status prisoners could live in conditions comparable to those they might expect outside. One such example was that while Walter Raleigh was held in the tower, his rooms were altered to accommodate his family, including his son, who was born there in 1605. It definitely don't sound like what you would think of prisons now. Executions were usually carried out on Tower Hill rather than in the Tower of London itself, and 112 people were executed on the hill over 400 years. Before the 20th century, there had been 7 executions within the castle on the Tower Green, as was the case with Lady Jane Grey. This was reserved for prisoners for whom public execution was considered dangerous. After Lady Jane Grey's execution on February 12, 1554, Queen Mary I imprisoned her sister Elizabeth, later Queen Elizabeth I, in the tower under suspicion of causing rebellion, as Sir Thomas Wyatt had led a revolt against Mary in Elizabeth's name. Now we're going to be jumping ahead a little bit farther. During the First World War, 11 men were tried in private and shot by firing squad at the tower for espionage. During the Second World War, the tower was once again used to hold prisoners of war. One such person was Rudolf Hess, Adolf Hitler's deputy, albeit just for 4 days in 1941. He was the last state prisoner to be held at the castle. The last person to be executed at the tower was a German spy named Joseph Jacobs, who was shot on August the 15th, 1941. The executions for espionage during the wars took place in a prefabricated miniature rifle range, which stood in the outer ward and was demolished in 1969. The Second World War also saw the last use of the tower as a fortification. In the event of a German invasion, the tower, together with the Royal Mint and nearby warehouses, was to have formed one of 3 keeps or complexes of defended buildings which formed the last-ditch defenses of the capital. Another thing the Tower of London was used for was also to host the crown jewels for the royal family. And that actually was started during the reign of Henry III, who reigned from 1216 to 1272. He had a nice long reign there, didn't he? The Jewel House was built specifically to house the royal regalia, including jewels, plate, and symbols of royalty, such as the crown, scepter, and sword. And from what I can tell, it's still used for that today. Now, let's move on to the ghosts of the Tower of London. The first spirits that I want to talk about that have been said to inhabit the tower were the spirit of two princes, Edward V and Richard. And the story about these two little boys were they were imprisoned in the tower by their uncle Richard, Duke of Gloucester, and purportedly was murdered on his order. When the bones of two small boys were found under the stairs in 1674, most people believed them to be the missing princes, and the bones were given a royal burial at Westminster Abbey. But the figures of two lost little boys wearing nightshirts and holding hands are frequently seen in the White Tower. Oddly enough, they have also been seen playing on the battlements, and some claim to have heard children giggling. One of our more famous spirits is of Sir Walter Raleigh. Sir Walter Raleigh was imprisoned in the Tower twice, once for a secret marriage and once for treason. Following his execution, his ghost has been seen wandering around the Bloody Tower, where he was imprisoned, as well as along the battlements known as Raleigh's Walk. The Grey Lady, now there's not much known about her. It says that her identity is uncertain, but the Grey Lady is a well-known resident in the Queen's House. The Grey Lady will only reveal herself to female visitors. Then there is Arbella Stewart. King James I did not give his permission for Arbella to marry William Seymour, and that was the nephew of Lady Jane Grey. Enraged at the insult and perceiving the marriage as a possible threat to his throne, James I imprisoned Arbella in the tower. She died there in 1615. Now, there's conflicting reports that claim that she either stopped eating or was murdered. And she also haunts the Queen's House. Here's another name that we mentioned earlier in the episode, and that was Guy Fawkes. And remember, we talked about him being tortured, and it said that you can hear his screams and cries from the council chamber in the White Tower where he was preparing for his execution. There was also Lady Jane Grey. She was only queen for 10 days before being executed by Mary, Queen of Scots. Lady Jane Grey and her husband, Lord Guildford Dudley, were advanced as an Anglican alternative to the Catholic Mary. Upon Mary's marriage to Philip of Spain and being crowned queen, she sentenced both to death and they were beheaded. Lady Jane's ghost is seen wandering the battlements as a lonely, solitary figure. Her husband, Lord Guildford Dudley, his ghost haunts Beauchamp Tower, sitting in his cell and weeping late into the night. Lord Dudley is also said to be responsible for the word Jane etched into the wall. Now, let's move to probably our best-known prisoner, and that would be Anne Boleyn. Anne was imprisoned in the tower and beheaded in 1536. And it's said that her headless torso paces upon the tower at night and is most frequently spotted in the chapel of St. Peter, where she was buried following her execution. In 1864, it's recorded that a soldier guarding the tower saw the terrifying headless figure of Anne. He panicked and tried to stab it with his bayonet. The dagger, of course, went straight through her ghostly figure. The soldier fainted from fright and was about to be court-martialed for being asleep on duty. And poor guy. He gets scared half to death, and then he gets in trouble for passing out. Oh, man, I feel bad for that guy. But fortunately, many other guards came forward and claimed they had also seen the ghost of Anne whilst on night duty. And as a result, the soldier was let off. Well, thank goodness. I feel a little better for that guy then. As mentioned, Anne's decapitated body was originally buried beneath the floor of St. Peter's Chapel. In 1876, Queen Victoria ordered that the bodies in the chapel be exhumed and buried more appropriately. A short while later, one of the captains of the guard was patrolling the tower at night and saw a strange flickering light in the chapel. Now, this is like my favorite part that I've come across because this sounds really cool. He climbed to one of the windows and pressed his face against the glass, and he was amazed by what he saw. Inside the chapel, he saw a procession of lords, ladies, and knights in armor. At the center of the festivity was a small, delicately dressed woman. Later, he identified her as being Anne Boleyn. He remained at the window, transfixed by this strange and otherworldly scene. And after a few minutes, the light in the chapel faded and the procession of ghosts disappeared into thin air. That is so cool. That would have been spooky, but awesome. Then there is the mysterious white woman in the castle keep. And almost every castle in England seems to be haunted by one common ghost. And it's a specter of a woman, either dressed in white or black robes. And the Tower of London is no different. Except in this case, the white woman of the Tower of London is a little bit spookier than most. Often visitors only glimpse a figure in white in the corner of their eyes. Then quite suddenly, they smell the terrible pungent smell of an old overpowering perfume. Yeah, sometimes some perfumes can just, you don't know how they got put, you know, into production, but I have smelled some perfumes that are pretty bad. Some visitors then describe the feeling of the world closing in around them and chills run from their neck down their spine. In recent years, tourists of the tower have even reported the sensation that something is tapping them on the shoulder. Now, here's a really strange story. Edmund Lenthal Swift was the keeper of the crown jewels between 1814 and 1852. He lived inside the Tower of London with his family, and he recorded a really spooky experience. And this is in his own words. It happened on a Saturday night in October at about the witching hour. And for those of y'all who don't know the witching hour, that's around like 3 o'clock in the morning. He was in the Jewel House that is now called Martin Tower, the doleful prison of Anne Boleyn. The windows were closed, the curtains were pulled over, and the room was lighted by a couple of candles, and his family were seated within. Suddenly, something very odd happened. Let's hear in exactly his own words. My wife looked up and exclaimed, "Good God, what is that?" I looked up and saw a cylindrical figure like a glass tube, seemingly about the thickness of my arm. It was hovering between the ceiling and the table. Its contents appeared to be a dense fluid, white and pale azure, like the gathering of summer cloud, and incessantly rolling and mingling within the cylinder. This lasted for about 2 minutes. Then it began slowly to move before my sister-in-law, then following the oblong shape of the table before my son and myself, passing behind my wife. It paused for a moment over her right shoulder. Instantly, she crouched down, and with both hands covering her shoulder, she shrieked out, "Oh, Christ, it has seized me." Even now, while writing, I feel the fresh horror of that moment. And lastly, what medieval castle can be haunted without having a ghost bear? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you heard me right, a ghost bear. Just days after the strange event, E.L. Swift wrote of something inexplicable which happened again in the Martin Tower. To help give it a bit of context, this story, we know that all types of exotic animals were imprisoned in the Tower of London during Tudor times. It was a bit like a modern zoo. Some of these animals still haunt the place. There are many stories describing the roars of long-lost lions which echo through the tower at night. I don't know about you all, but that would just freak me out, hearing a roaring lion at night. Some have also described the phantom shapes of horses which gallop along the cobbles at night. their eyes a terrifying blaze red. Nope. Nope. I'd be going the other direction. I'd be like the little boy in the meme running down the hall, seeing something and turning around and going back. Red-eyed horses. That doesn't do it for me. Too much a reminder of the legend of Sleepy Hollow, I guess. However, this animal from the underworld was something more ominous altogether. I'll again quote from E.L. Swift's writing in the 1800s. One of the sentries at the Martin Tower was alarmed by a figure like a huge bear emerging from underneath the door. He thrust at it with his bayonet, which stuck in the door. He dropped in a fit and was carried senseless to the guardroom. Of all of this, I avouch nothing more than I saw the poor man in the guardhouse prostrated with terror. And then, in 2 or 3 days, the fatal result was that he died. This chilling tale has been told and retold over the years, and many people say the bear was no less than the devil in a ghostly disguise, pulling the hapless to the underworld with him. And now one last story here, and we're going to be talking about Henry VIII's armor. Have your wits about you when you visit the tower, because one of the most popular exhibits, the old armor of King Henry VIII, is said to be possessed by a particularly malevolent ghost. To explain, over the years, many guards have reported horrible sensations when patrolling the Tower of London at night. And obviously, because we've talked about several times guards seeing spirits. Different men and women have described the feelings of dread or chills running through their spine when entering a particular chamber. However, some guards have told of truly harrowing experiences. Some describe walking into a room and feeling like they're being crushed alive. Some say that it feels like a demon has jumped from the ceiling and has wrapped its arms tight around their chest and is trying to suffocate them. Others say that it feels like an invisible monster is trying to strangle them. They felt the tight grip of hands around their neck and have stumbled, gasping for oxygen, into another room. Yeah, that's not cool. There is even a tale which tells of a guard being assaulted by a ghost wielding a visible cloak. Again, the guard struggled as he felt the cloak wrap right around his neck. He managed to escape the room, but although his assailant was invisible, the remaining bright red marks on his neck were real. All of those stories of suffocation and strangling have one thing in common. They occurred in the room storing Henry VIII's armor. Whenever the armor was moved in the Tower of London, these terrible experiences would occur in the same room. Nowadays, the armor is on plain display in the tower, and I would advise you to be very careful when you pay it a visit. It seems to be the home of one of those vicious Tower of London ghosts. Well, guys, that is the Tower of London. And I got to say, that is a pretty interesting place to be if you want to go and look for spirits. Now, I don't know if they ever host any kind of ghost hunts, and I doubt that they do, considering that they do keep the crown jewels there. But there is certainly enough stories to go around at the tower to keep your interest piqued for a good long time. Today we actually have something that we've not had in quite a while. We actually have a story from one of our listeners. And this person, he actually chose to keep his identity secret. And he would like to be referred to as Mr. Templeton. And he wrote, "I had a grandfather who lived just over the mountain in North Carolina. We would always visit on Sundays and a few times during the week. I don't know why I remember this so well, but it's always been in the back of my mind. When we would go visit as kids, during doing what kids do Once we pulled into the drive, we couldn't wait to get out and play. Now, I don't know the reason why, but we was told not to go past the barn and had to stay on this side and play. It was an old dirt road, and it didn't stop at the barn. It kept going to an old location where a house once stood. I remember going past the barn one time, being in the moment of playing. I think we were throwing a ball, and once I picked up the ball, I saw a lady in a white dress just up the road from me, and I stood there and watched her. She walked back over a small bridge through a white painted fence that surrounded a small white house carrying a basket. Nothing scary, just her in the yard wandering. I never ventured past the barn again. However, I would get as close to the edge of the barn so I wouldn't be going past it and didn't want to get in trouble and watch her. I did not dare say anything to anyone else. Every visit after, I would find myself at the corner of the barn watching her. I haven't thought about it. In fact, I almost forgot about it until about 5 years ago. I had a dream that took me back to the corner of the barn, and there she was, still wandering around the yard with her basket, picking flowers or whatever she was picking. I know it's not a scary or frightening story, but it was a ghost story. And you know what? It doesn't have to be scary or frightening. I mean, I know I want to go out and, you know, hear all these wonderful stories of experiences that people have, because, you know, I think there are more experiences out there that people are afraid to share because, you know, some people don't, want to be criticized for, or saying, oh, maybe you just weren't feeling well or things like that. When in reality, you know, these experiences really did happen to them, you know, and I can't discount anybody's experience, you know, especially after my trip to Tipton Haynes. I've done two ghost hunts there, and I have definitely seen, to me, pretty compelling evidence that ghosts exist. And, you know, who is it to me to say that your experience was not real? Folks, I hope you all have a great week. And, you know, if you really like the show, go out and give us a rating and review on iTunes. You have no idea how much that helps us out. You can also email me at john@boommydadsays.com if you want to send your personal stories to us. And we'll be happy to read them on the air. And just like Mr. Templeton here, we will give you a pseudonym if you choose. And also, if you would like to help the show out with some of our production costs and things like that, so we can continue to keep bringing you quality content, you can do a donation to the show through buymeacoffee.com/boommydadsays. And I think it's like you can do like as little as a one-time $2 donation or something like that. Or you can, I think you can also set up to do a continuous monthly donation. But anything that you all would do, we certainly do appreciate. And we think you guys are some of the best listeners in the world. And just thank you so much for listening to our show. And we will see you again next week. We hope y'all have a great week. Goodbye. And God bless, my friends. Oh, and one more thing. How would you guys like to listen to some blooper reels this episode? Well, here you go. The tower has served variously as an armory, a treasury, a menagerie, the home of the Royal Mint, a public refer? The new ruling elite undertook what has been described as the most extensive and concentrated program of castle building in the world. They were multi-purpose buildings served as fortifications, used as a base of operations in enemy territory. Centuries of administration. You've got what's called like the innermost most. Longchamp capitulated to John after just 3 days. The beginning of the Tudor period marked the start of the decline of the Tower of London's use as a royal residence. As 16th century chronicler Raphael Holinshed said, the tower became used more as an armorous and house of munition, and there to the beginning of the Tudor period marked the start of the decline of the Tower of London's use as a royal residence. As 16th city. Something very odd happened. So let's hear what he said in his exact words. My wife looked up and exclaimed, "Good God, what is that?" I looked up and saw a cylindrical bulbous walrus. The foul run afoul of a I love that commercial. All right. Suddenly something very odd happened. Let's hear it in exactly his own words. My wife looked up and exclaimed, "Good God, what is that?" I looked up and saw a cylindrical